Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
A very warm welcome to the Strategy and Insider podcast. My name is Thomas and I'm your host. In this episode, we will turn towards the pharma industry with a representative of one of the world's leading producers of biosimilars and generics. What biosimilars are and what makes them essential for a healthcare system will only be two of the exciting topics that I promise we will discuss in this episode. So without further ado, I'm pleased to introduce today's guest, Isabel Remus. Isabel is the global head of biosimilars at Sandoz, which is a global leader in affordable medicines that manufactures generics, pharmaceuticals, and biosimilars with a portfolio of more than 1,300 products. Sandoz became an independent entity back in October 23 after its parent company, Novartis, spun off its generics and biosimilars division. Isabel joined Novartis back in 2003 as a global brand manager at their headquarters in Basel, Switzerland. She has since held numerous leadership roles within Novartis and Sandoz, with a particular focus on biosimilars for over a decade, actually. Initially, she studied European Business Administration in Reutlingen and is a trained advertising merchant. So I'm sure there is a lot to talk about, and thank you for joining me here in Munich today, Isabel.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm really happy to be with you today.
Hey, I would like to really start on a somewhat personal note. I was wondering what actually sparked your interest to pursue a career in the pharma industry? Because given your background, which is in marketing and advertising, and your first professional experience at a consumer goods company, Procter & Gamble, where you spent more than 5 years actually, you could have easily led to a similar impressive career in the consumer industry. So how did your path lead you to where you are today?
No, it's an interesting question. You know, I think I was always interested in health, probably because my parents were not so well when I grew up. And I did enter Novartis as an experiment. That's how it was presented to me. Novartis at the time was not so happy with their marketing. And so they wanted to bring in people with a consumer background. And so one evening I received a phone call. I had to do many, many interviews. I won't tell you how many. And then I received the offer to start in the cardiovascular area. And so I literally went from managing Pampers in Greece to, you know, working on a cholesterol-lowering drug in Switzerland.
Oh, wow.
That's the story.
How was the water? Was it that cold that you would guess? Or was it kind of yesterday Pampers or napkins and then we're looking after the heart? I mean, how did it feel?
You know, it was really interesting because I did realize that people were thinking differently than I was. And, you know, they had gone through a different school than I did. And bringing those two things together, we could really make a difference.
I like that. So after you joined then Novartis back in 2003, you actually lived in Switzerland for a couple of years before you actually then relocated to Holzkirchen, which some of you in Germany listening might know, but others probably not, which is a rather small city in Bavaria with roughly 16,000 inhabitants, but a surprisingly prominent list actually of companies that have a branch office there, next to Sandoz and Exal. There is also Bosch and Panasonic, for example. What are the key advantages that you would see and unique challenges also of such companies going there, operating in the Bavarian hinterland, so to say? And additionally, I'd love to hear your personal insights about working there yourself.
So Holzkirchen is home of our German headquarters. We also have corporate offices there. We have a biosimilar development center, and it's also a manufacturing site for us where we produce roughly 60 million patches per year. So it's quite a big site for us. It does look small on paper, Holzkirchen, I agree with you, but it's only 30 minutes from the Munich Central Station. So it's very well connected to strong pharma industry in Bavaria and also the university landscape. And this makes this location special because, you know, you've got this access to Munich's talent and the research environment. But as you already, you know, alluded to, it has a calmer, more focused setting that avoids these big city drawbacks like, you know, high cost, heavy traffic and the space constraints. And I think that this matters, especially if you look at the science-driven work that we also do there in our development center. And you know, like you said, there's quite a few companies that are equally seeing these advantages. I personally really enjoy working in Holzkirchen. I like the offices, and believe it or not, it's a very international group that works there. So we have almost 1,800 employees there, from 45 nationalities. So it's a very international hub. And what's nice is that everyone working there is really united by our purpose to enhance access to medicines for patients. And I'll invite you, you know, it'd be great if you could come one day and just feel that, you know, the spirit that we have in Holzkirchen.
No, I'll definitely take you up on that. And also, you're producing patches.
Patches, oh, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Nice. So, I mean, judging from your tenure of more than 10 years in the field of biosimilars, let's get a bit more technical, I would say, right? Mm-hmm. Because we also want to educate a bit based on your experience that you're currently having, but also from previous engagements mm-hmm. that you made at Biosimilars Medicine Sector Group at Medicines for Europe. This is clearly something that is close to your heart, right? Mm-hmm. And you're saying also that the team is very much behind this and driven by the purpose mm-hmm. and being passionate mm-hmm. about it. So in short, can you just explain what biosimilars are and mm-hmm. what personally fascinates you about them.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's true. You know, I started working on biosimilars in 2008, and that's not so long after they were launched. And we can talk a little bit later, you know, what it was at that time to be involved in the launch and that. But to understand biosimilars, we actually, you know, have to widen our lens, first of all, and really look at the category of biologic medicines as a whole. Biologics are really essential and life-changing medicines, you know, and they provide the standard of care now in many areas because they are very targeted, they're precision-based treatments. But to develop and supply these medicines is really complex and it's time-consuming. And it's expensive compared to most medicines that are made via chemical synthesis, which makes these drugs expensive, these biologic drugs expensive for the healthcare system. And that's, you know, where you have this tension between innovation on one hand and then accessibility on the other hand. And this is really where biosimilars enter the picture. So fundamentally, biosimilars have the same equivalent efficacy and comparable safety to their reference medicine. Because to enable a broader patient reach, which you want for these critical drugs, and you also want healthcare sustainability, and you don't want to compromise quality and efficacy, that's really, you know, what biosimilars bring. But biosimilars only come to the market when the biologic, what we call the reference medicine, has lost its compound patent. And our goal is to be really ready for that moment when that happens. Mm-hmm. It's usually a day. It's one day, and all our engine, you know, our development
needs to start working right away.
Exactly. Yeah? It's really, you know, built to be able to launch the product on that day. And why that might sound trivial, it actually is rather complex, because there's a few things that, you know, play a role. Number one, you know, we need to look into the future. So we start developing, you know, number of years before we bring the product to the market. So we need to understand, is this product still a viable therapy at that point in time? You know, when does the product really lose patent? What does it take to develop or manufacture the product and also to commercialize it? Mm. So these are all considerations that are coming in. You know, we make sure we get ready on time and then, you know, launch on that day. And to your question, you know, what connects me? For me, it's really, you know, this patient access that is so critical. In my family, you know, we've got autoimmune disease, and it's really amazing to see that once, you know, a biologic therapy starts or a biosimilar is being used, what that does to the patient, you know, the quality of life, how, you know, things improve, the disease gets or the symptoms get changed. And not just for the patient, but then also for the whole surrounding, you know, the family and then the caregivers. And that's really what gets me up in the morning and lets me, you know, gives me energy and makes me want to work for biosimilars.
And I have to admit that I'm really very happy and glad that we're having this dialogue, because in the podcast episodes that we're usually having, we're focusing a lot on the futuristic, what's coming next, what's the kind of the next evolution of medicines and innovation. And we need to keep thriving for innovation. Yep. At the same time, we need to counterbalance to keep it also affordable.
Absolutely.
And hence, I'm fully with you, generics and biosimilars do play an imminent role in this. And probably deep diving a bit on that still, where the differences are between a biologics innovation asset versus a biosimilar, where the similarities, but also the differences are when it comes to R&D, manufacturing, but also IP. Probably you can shed some light on what makes the one versus the other.
Okay. All right. Interesting question. I'll start with this, you know, where it's more similar, and then we'll go to where it's more different. So, you know, biosimilars are also manufactured with the technology at the same quality standards that are used for reference biologic medicines. There's absolutely no difference. Just to give you an example of what it takes to build these manufacturing capacities, Sandoz is investing currently $1.1 billion to create a state-of-the-art end-to-end manufacturing network for biosimilars in Slovenia. So it's multiple sites that we build there to bring biosimilars to the world. The development is sort of in the middle, you know, because we have a different starting point, but then a familiar pathway. And the starting point for a biosimilar is always, you know, the already approved reference medicine. You know, we don't search for innovation.
You compare against it then,
but
right?
Our goal is exactly, our goal is to be as close as possible to the reference medicine, because we cannot have any clinically meaningful differences. Actually, interestingly, we sometimes find improvements, or we're because it's, you know, 20, 30 years after the originator drug was developed, we find innovations, we find improvements, but we can't bring them to the market.
I was going to ask, this is to be regulated then, right? So you can just say, hey, we found something, here it is, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, our goal is to be as similar as possible. And then, you know, also in terms of, you know, how the data is being reviewed and approved, is actually the same regulatory authorities, you know, the European Medicines Agency or the US Food and Drug Administration, and they use the same standard, you know, as for the biologic drugs. And so, you know, I just want to make sure that people understand that the moment a biosimilar is approved, you know, you can really expect the same outcome. On the IP side, that's probably where we've got the biggest differences, because the, you know, the reference biologics are granted patents, and like I shared earlier, the biosimilars can only launch after the relevant patents have expired. And you can imagine that, you know, these biologic innovative products are lucrative products for a company. And so, you know, the brand manufacturers are usually keen to protect and ideally extend the exclusivity for as long as they can. And so to do this, what they do is that they build up what we call estates of patents. So, you know, directed at secondary aspects of the products, like the formulation or the methods of treatment. And those estates get even larger as the brand manufacturers, you know, also obtain several patents, sometimes exactly to the same invention. And so what might happen is that, you know, a patent is being filed, but it's dismissed. And then, you know, the company would try along the same lines to get again a patent, but with a slightly tweaked filing. And that makes it very difficult, you know, for a biosimilar company, because effectively, you know, watching that IP landscape, challenging it, you know, achieving the right decisions in court is a big part of what we're actually doing. And we're very, you know, active with patent offices and courts and also patient associations or industry associations, to implement reforms to these IP policies, because we actually think that we should put an end to this behavior and really make sure that we support the timely access to biosimilars without, you know, compromising pharmaceutical innovation. So that's a big part of understanding biosimilars, actually.
No, absolutely. And this is kind of a fine balance to strike, of course, right? On the one hand, you want to foster innovation, and then want to keep pharma companies investing into innovation, and that needs a certain return. At the same time, affordability kicks in because you want to broaden the access, right?
Absolutely.
And you mentioned time. Just if I can just pick on that, because timing in generics and biosimilars is obviously of utmost importance,
absolutely,
right? So if we kind of think in terms of the winner takes it all, it's probably not all, but a large share, whoever comes first. I mean, isn't this also difficult to find the right time when you start investing into R&D, when you start investing into ramp up of production capability and capacity?
Of course.
And obviously you are also in a race against others. How difficult is this? And what are kind of the judgment calls that you need to make at some point as well?
Yeah? I always say to people that you really need to be able to manage ambiguity.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, things are often uncertain until the last minute. And, you know, I always say to people that, you know, you have a plan A that you work against, but in the back of your mind, you need to have plan B, C, D, E. Because as you say, you know, there are multiple facets that are coming together and that you need to, you know, keep an eye on, and that might change the situation. And so it's a very, very dynamic environment, which, you know, I really enjoy. You know, you were asking earlier, you know, what do I enjoy? I'm driven by the access, but I do enjoy that, you know, that ambiguity that this environment has and the challenge that this brings. It's not trivial, you know, and it also means that you're not always right. You know, you cannot always assess it to 100%, but we do our best, and we've got great teams in place that really master this.
Yeah, it must be. And as you mentioned already, the EMA and FDA, probably also touching up on a bit of the regulation side of it, there is movements towards regulatory harmonization also for biosimilars, both in the US with FDA and in Europe with EMA. How are evolving regulatory frameworks actually impacting the biosimilars market? And what role do proactive policy changes actually play in also hopefully accelerating access to these medicines globally?
We actually, you know, in 25, it has been a year where we've seen really major regulatory authorities moving in the same direction. And the term is streamlining biosimilar development, which, you know, is really going to change the biosimilar landscape. So, you know, what we're seeing is that with novel state-of-the-art methods, you can actually shift away from costly and time-consuming phase three studies, you know, that were required in the past. So in 2004, the European Medicines Agency was the first agency to set up a biosimilar regulatory pathway, you know, because it was a novel concept and they needed to respond to that. And the requirements from 2004 entail extensive head-to-head analytical, preclinical, and clinical comparative studies. And this was a very cautionary approach. But to be honest with you, it did help to gain the trust of prescribers and patients. So I think it was good. But it relied on the analytical tools and the manufacturing processes 20 or even more years ago. And today, you know, things have become much more precise. Mm-hmm. And what we did learn is that the analytical and the clinical pharmacokinetic studies are actually much more sensitive in finding differences between the biosimilar and the reference medicine than comparative efficacy studies. And so streamlined development in effect means that those comparative efficacy studies are no longer needed because, you know, a drug or a biosimilar can be assessed in other terms. So that's one big movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second big movement is really the international harmonization of the requirements. Because imagine you develop a drug and you've got one requirement from EMA, one requirement from the FDA, one requirement from the Japanese authorities, another one from the Brazilian authorities, yeah. and so forth. That is very, you know, costly and very inefficient. Mm. And so it's really great, you know, that there's now an International Council of Harmonization that really looks at the requirements across the globe and is working on a harmonized approach, including, you know, streamlined biosimilar development to drive that efficiency.
Now, I mean, let's hope that we're going to see this rather soon than only in, I don't know, the 5 to 7 years from now. But I clearly hear what you're saying. Harmonization would obviously take out or gain efficiency to everybody,
Absolutely.
Which again contributes to affordability for the system.
And
the
access. And then you're
and
back
access.
To back
exactly.
to access. Absolutely.
So surely patient education and awareness are both crucial for biosimilar adoption. However, there must be reservations also towards those medicines, often due to a lack, I guess, of information, because people will ask themselves, is this really as good as the original one? What initiatives that you as a company are undertaking to improve the understanding of biosimilars among healthcare providers and patients to take away that kind of perception that this might not be the right one for me because it's now my medication and this is not something that others are taking, but it's affecting me and is this really the right medication for me?
Mm. Yeah. You know, when I started working on biosimilars, it was, you know, 2 years after biosimilars were launched. And the belief was that it's approved, so it's got, you know, the official stamp. It's significantly cheaper than the mm-hmm. originator product, that this would sell by itself. And it didn't happen. You know, the product was on the market, but it wasn't used because the education was missing and the trust, therefore, mm-hmm. was not in place. And I think for us as a company, this was really an important learning, and we started to change things as a result of that, that we need to build that trust first, and that requires education. So, you know, for us, it's really important that, you know, every drug we launch, we have that education in place.
Mm-hmm.
Less so now in areas like oncology and immunology, because their physicians are very familiar with these kind of drugs.
Yeah.
Patients, you know, are familiar, patient associations are familiar. But the moment we enter a new therapeutic area, it's absolutely critical. And we just launched a product in the multiple sclerosis space. And again, you know, it was very critical for us to go back and start with the education, because the stakeholders working in the MS space and patients were not familiar with biosimilars. And so we needed to start that. But this requires, you know, really tight collaboration. We can't do this on our own. And so I mentioned patient associations a few times. They play a critical role mm-hmm. because they provide us, you know, with their needs, their concerns, their expectations. And they really help us to create initiatives that serve the patients well. The other thing that we learned is that the engagement needs to happen at the country level. It's really important because there are differences in healthcare systems, there are differences in treatment pathways and local expectations. And if we do that locally, it just makes it more relevant mm-hmm. and more trusted. And, you know, maybe to give you an example of an initiative that we're driving, it's an initiative we call Making Access Happen Forum, where we bring patient advocacy groups together from across countries. Mm-hmm. This one is, you know, has more than 30 patient advocacy leaders from 18 countries, and they collaboratively work, you know, how we can become better, how education can become better, and they can learn from each other. And mm-hmm. we're expanding this in 24. It started in 25. We added more patient groups, and you know, we want to expand this even further because we see the value of these critical people to connect and share their experiences.
So talking connectivity, a very warm invitation then to also our upcoming Future of Health Forum in November this year. So we'd be glad to have you and probably also some of the patient advocacy groups also joining, because it's an important component to it. Yeah. So switching back a bit in the years, because you said you started in 2008, which is 2 years after the first biosimilar actually made it to market. So in 2006, Sonder was actually the first to launch a biosimilar, which is a drug that is indicated to treat growth disorders, especially among children. Actually, it consists of a recombinant human growth hormone, somatropin, that aims to support the growth and the development of bones and muscles. And since then, Sonder has marketed 12 other biosimilars and boasts actually a pipeline of even 27 candidates. So according to the latest figures, the pipeline has sales reference of approximately $200 billion, notably in oncology and autoimmune diseases. Without obviously disclosing too much, can you tell us a bit more about the pipeline and if there are any particular medicines or therapeutic areas that you are very much excited about?
You know, when you look at our pipeline, you always need to look at it in the context of the loss of exclusivities that are happening, right? That determines our pipeline. And we enter a phase that we do call the golden decade of biosimilars. So if you look at the next 10 years, we estimate that, you know, biologic medicines worth around $320 billion in sales will lose exclusivity. So that's an unprecedented number. And you heard that I said we estimate, because we were talking about the uncertainty earlier, right? So this is our estimate. And really, that represents really a transformative moment for global healthcare, because it opens the door to much wider patient access to these critical therapies than we've ever seen before. And within that context, Sandoz is targeting around 60% of that total opportunity, which gives you a sense of, you know, on one hand, the ambition, and on the other hand, of the scale that we're currently working on. And you're right, today we have a pipeline of 27 biosimilar assets. And that positions us well to continue to deliver on our purpose, you know, to deliver or to pioneer access for patients. And these assets span a broad range of therapeutic areas, reflecting where we believe unmet needs are greatest and where biosimilars can really make the biggest difference. Oncology is the major focus, of course, also because the LOEs linked to oncology play a significant role, but also because, you know, the burden of cancer and the cost of biologic treatments in that area is really substantial. But the pipeline goes beyond that. So we are also, like you said earlier, active in immunology. We were active in diabetes, in ophthalmology, in neurology, just to name a few areas where expanding access can really have a profound impact on patients' lives.
And this is super fascinating. So in Europe, and especially in Germany, we recently experienced various supply shortages, unfortunately, of important medicines such as antibiotics or also children's medications. In total, more than 500 prescription drugs are in scarce supply, we unfortunately have to recognize. How can biosimilars and generics help to increase the resilience of supply chains that we're having in place globally and ensure steady supply of these critical therapeutics?
I think a lot. And the reason is, you know, when you have multiple qualified manufacturers that are supplying your critical medicines, your healthcare systems reduces dependence on single sources. I think it's very easy how generics and biosimilars can help here. And, you know, if you don't rely on a single source, you're going to be much better to absorb, any shocks when disruptions occur. So, you know, from that perspective, it makes all sense. You know, at Sandoz, resilience is built through a diversified global manufacturing network with really a strong European footprint. And recent investments include the significant investment into an end-to-end penicillin supply chain in Austria, and also the more than $1 billion investment that we talked about earlier into a manufacturing hub in Slovenia. And both are really aimed at securing reliable supply for our European patients. But you know, resilience can't be delivered by the industry alone. That would be not possible, but it really requires a close collaboration across the entire ecosystem, you know, whether it's manufacturers, it's pharmacists, wholesalers, but also importantly, regulators and policymakers and patient groups, and all have a role to play together. And that's why we're also really actively supporting any collaborative system-wide approaches. Like, we participate in initiatives like the EU Critical Medicines Alliance, because they bring together the different stakeholders in order to really look at how to strengthen Europe's supply for these critical medicines. The other thing we should look at is really, you know, how are products, how are our drugs procured? Because also there, this also has an impact on resilience. And so, for example, rather than having single winners in tenders, you know, why not having multiple winners, you know, as a very simple example, or providing sufficient lead times. And I think we really need to, you know, look at how do we ensure a healthy, a sustainable environment for these critical drugs, so that you have a more resilient supply chain. And as you said, we've seen how quickly things can tip and how critical it is to have an eye on that.
And seeing this, that also Europe, but also Germany is suffering from this, right? Very rich region in the world, very rich country like Germany, and we're still having these type of problems. It's not only to do with money, but also with kind of diversity of supply, I'm hearing.
Absolutely. That's
a good one to keep in mind. So probably picking a bit more on that access to medicines, which is obviously a cornerstone of equitable healthcare and also a matter of public health. By providing more affordable generics and biosimilars, companies like yourselves aim to lower costs and obviously increase access. And according to Sandoz's 2024 annual report, if I'm informed correct, this generated about $19 billion US dollar in direct savings for healthcare systems, both in the US and Europe alone, as well as a total social impact of approximately $400 billion worldwide. So improving access is especially crucial for obviously low to middle income countries, which are disproportionately burdened by both communicable but also non-communicable diseases. From your perspective, what are key strategies pharmaceutical companies like Sandoz should adopt to enhance the affordability and also the accessibility to medicines?
Well, you know that pioneering access is really our purpose. It's the purpose at Sandoz. And so we're very, very connected to this. And, you know, we know now that producing affordable medicines doesn't guarantee access by itself, but we need to remove barriers that prevent patients from receiving treatments. Like we said, you know, the regulatory hurdles, the patents, ensuring there's awareness and trust. And these levers, you know, are important to be brought to life. Now, coming to the low or lower middle income countries, the disease burden is high, and the access gaps are often widest. And, you know, this is really striking because it's important that we improve access in these countries. At Sandoz, you know, we've got a strong presence. We operate in more than half of these countries with really thousands of employees and good local supplier networks. And products are reaching underserved and even disaster-affected population. But, you know, we do need to continue to support education in these areas, and we need to ensure that healthcare providers prescribe the right medicines to the right patients at the right time by engaging with patient groups, especially in these countries, to understand what their local needs are and what their challenges are. So the strategy is quite clear. We need affordable medicines. We need fewer systematic barriers and really strong local engagement and the right policies in these countries to make sure that access is broadened.
I like that a lot, kind of that broad perspective of what it's needed actually to increase access to medicines. And based on that, at the same time, the demand of affordable medicines is putting pressure on revenue margins, of course, right? And limiting commercial flexibility, especially for generics producers, because the margin must also get under pressure because the competition is high. How do you balance the imperative to provide accessible medicine at an affordable cost with a need to maintain still commercial viability, because also you're taking risks, you're managing uncertainty, you're spending R&D money on things that might probably even never come or only in a limited manner come?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think it's really at the core of what we do. And in a nutshell, we can only expand access to affordable medicines if our business remains commercially viable.
Yes.
There is absolutely no question. We achieve this through a combination of scale and efficiency, deep manufacturing and supply expertise, a strategic pipeline selection and portfolio management that we talked earlier about. I mean, really this engagement with the key stakeholders. And, you know, we do operate at large scale. I think this really helps us. We have 1,300 products that we supply into more than 100 countries. And that scale really allows us to focus on high volume, high impact medicines where we can drive these efficiencies that we need in order to help offset pricing pressures, while at the same time, and that's non-negotiable, ensuring that quality and that reliability. But we also are selective, you know, and strategic in our pipeline and portfolio selection. And to be honest with you, not every molecule or every market makes sense. So, you know, we need to have that that in mind. And we want to focus on areas that we can truly make a difference while we still generate these returns that allow us to reinvest then in future access. And then, you know, it's the collaboration with the different stakeholders, because it requires this entire ecosystem that needs to work, and that's really where, you know, we spend a lot of our time and energies to shape that.
What a great ending, and thanks for sharing an outlook to come. Really big thanks to you, Isabel, for this very insightful discussion on the world of generics and biosimilars. I could clearly hear, but also see your passion for it. You really drive to make a difference, and especially your perspective on the impact on affordability, the impact on sustainable, trustworthy access to medicines in need, but also the management, also a bit the art of managing uncertainty in the process of generics and biosimilars is obviously very compelling and will certainly provide much food for thought. And I'm sure our listeners also learned, hopefully, a lot. Many thanks to everybody who joined us today. Please make sure to visit us on your preferred podcast platform to catch up on previous episodes. And please do keep an eye for our next exciting topic that is coming up soon. But until then, take care and goodbye.
Strategy made real.